Okay. If you've got a Bible, open to Luke chapter 16. If you don't have a Bible with you, there are hardback black Bibles in the pews and rows. We're on page 875. Sometimes Jesus deliberately makes things difficult. And the folks near you who are giggling are aware that our text today is an example of Jesus deliberately making things difficult. So I'm going to read it in just a moment. The text hinges on two facts that I at least am tempted to wiggle out from underneath. But there they are. Fact number one, the main character in the story Jesus tells is a steward, a sort of chief servant of a large household, and the steward is a scumbag. Every single thing he does in the story is scummy and sleazy. That's fact number one. Fact number two, at the end of the story, Jesus holds the steward up as an example to be imitated. That's where we're starting from. Listen to the word of God. Jesus also said to the disciples, "There was a rich man who had a manager, a steward, and charges were brought to him that this man was wasting his possessions. And the master called him and said to him, 'What is this that I hear about you? Turn in the account of your management, for you can no longer be manager.' And the manager said to himself, 'What shall I do, since my master is taking the management away from me? I'm not strong enough to dig, and I am ashamed to beg. I have decided what to do, so that when I am removed from management, people may receive me into their houses.' So summoning his master's debtors one by one, the manager said to the first, 'How much do you owe my master?' He said, 100 measures of oil. The manager said to him, 'Take your bill and sit down quickly and write 50. Then he said to another, 'How much do you owe?' And he said, 100 measures of wheat. He said to him, 'Take your bill and write 80. The master commended the dishonest manager for his shrewdness. For the sons of this world are more shrewd in dealing with their own generation than the sons of light. And I tell you, make friends for yourselves by means of unrighteous wealth, so that when it fails, they may receive you into the eternal dwellings.'" This is the word of the Lord. And you guys all understand it perfectly, so. Couple of introductory framing comments. There is the temptation to, if not avoid this text altogether and just move on to verse 10, at least alter the reality. You know, we might be tempted to try to turn the dishonest manager into like a Robin Hood figure. Like maybe the rich man is an oppressive, tyrannical rich man, and the manager is shrewdly, cleverly taking from the rich to give to the poor. No, that's a nice idea. It doesn't match any of the facts of the story as Jesus tells it. We might be tempted to at least like de-emphasize or minimize the point. You know, maybe Jesus is just saying, hey, in case you find yourself in this exact situation, it might be all right to do this. But no, he's making a much broader point about priorities, the nature of God and salvation, and wisdom. That's the second comment. The word used to commend the dishonest manager is shrewd. So this is verse 8. The master commended the dishonest manager for his shrewdness, for the sons of this world are more shrewd in dealing with their own generation than the sons of light. Shrewd, that translation, it's a valid translation of the Greek word phronimos, but it has a kind of a negative connotation, right? Like if you're shrewd, you're sort of like underhanded clever. The word that Jesus uses here is a much broader and more positive word. It means something like prudence or practical wisdom. So he's commending the prudence and the wisdom of this manager. At the same time that he calls the guy dishonest, which in Greek is actually unrighteous. So the bad, wise manager. That's Jesus' assessment. He puts bad, unrighteous, wicked, right next to wise and prudent. He's being difficult on purpose. Because Jesus is aware of everyone who is listening. So there are three groups listening in to this story. And this story is a continuation. You need to know that while the Bible, the text, is the inspired word of God, the chapter numbers are not. We stuck those in later for convenience, right? And the marker for chapter 16 is a wrong interruption of a continuing story. So this is an ongoing conversation that Jesus has been having since the beginning of chapter 15. Right? So the setting for this parable of the unrighteous, dishonest, also wise and prudent manager is this. Now the tax collectors and sinners were all drawing near to hear Jesus, and the Pharisees and the scribes grumbled, saying, "This man receives sinners and eats with them." And then Jesus began to teach them. And he goes through what we spent the last month on, right? The parables of the lost sheep and the lost coin and the two lost sons. Remember, both sons are lost. And then he goes right in to the story of the bad wise manager. And in this, he's teaching the tax collectors and sinners, the people who look obviously unrighteous to everyone. He's teaching the Pharisees, the upstanding religious leaders who look righteous to everyone. And particularly in this story, he's teaching the disciples, right? Chapter 16 begins, Jesus also said to the disciples, to his followers whom he is preparing to become the new religious leaders and displace the Pharisees. And he's trying to address all of them. And he gives them a story in which an obviously unrighteous, sinful person is held up as a wise, positive example. This is a story for current and future upstanding religious folks, for us to be willing to learn from folks we instinctively look down on. Jesus, he makes the dishonest manager someone you want to look down on. And then he holds him up as someone to look up to. Why? What's going on here? It matters a lot that what Jesus commends the dishonest manager for, the unrighteous steward, is for wisdom, for prudence, for knowing what's going on in the world and how to live in response to it. That's wisdom, right? Actionable knowledge. And he's saying, this guy who looks so bad, he knows himself better than you know yourselves. He knows God better than you know God. And he knows money better than you know money. On the subjects of self, God, and money, this guy is wiser than you are. This guy has wisdom you can learn from. And he's inviting us to learn, and specifically to learn from someone we would instinctively assume we have nothing to learn from. So first, Jesus wants us to know ourselves, and he holds up this guy as someone who knows himself. The steward knows himself to be unrighteous. He knows that he is bad. And in this, he is wiser than all sorts of upstanding religious folks. So quickly, righteousness in Scripture. Righteousness is right behavior plus right relationship. So righteousness is not just rule following. It is the combination of behaving correctly and then having good relationships. And these two things go together. They flow one from the other. So when it comes to words, when it comes to speaking, the Bible teaches that righteous speech is speaking the truth in love. That if we habitually speak the truth to one another out of love for one another, that will lead to right relationships, right? Right behavior, right relationships. If we behave wrongly when it comes to speech, if we lie to one another, or if we are heroic, harsh truth tellers to one another, that will lead to wrong relationships. Right? You all have experience of this. Right? It's the combination of right behavior and right relationship that is righteousness. And the steward knows himself to be unrighteous. Now, his behavior, right from the beginning, is unrighteous. It's wrong behavior, right? Verse 1, there was a rich man who had a manager, and charges were brought to him that this man was wasting his possessions. The whole point of having a steward is to take good care of your stuff. That's why you have a household manager. And this manager is doing the opposite of that. That word, wasting his possessions, it's exactly the same word as in chapter 15, verse 13. Not many days later, the younger son gathered all he had and took a journey into a far country, and there he wasted his property in reckless living. The dishonest manager is deliberately parallel to the younger son in chapter 15, and he's doing exactly the same unrighteous squandering. Right? So his behavior is absolutely unrighteous, but here's the thing. This guy accepts that his behavior is unrighteous and that as a consequence, his relationship with the master is broken. He acknowledges his unrighteousness. There's something missing from the story that if you're familiar with people in the Bible being confronted with their unrighteousness, stands out. So there was a rich man who had a manager, and charges were brought to him that this man was wasting his possessions. And the rich man called the manager and said to him, "What is this that I hear about you? Turn in the account of your management, for you can no longer be manager." And then the manager said to the rich man, wait a second. You don't understand. This is a really big, hard job. You got to cut me some slack here. The other servants are at least as responsible for this mess as I am. I deserve a second chance." He doesn't say any of that. He doesn't shift blame. He doesn't minimize his unrighteousness. He doesn't offer any excuses. He accepts that he has been unrighteous, and as a consequence, his relationship with the master is broken. He knows himself. He is wise. This, in direct contrast to the Pharisees, whereas the manager understands, knows that he is unrighteous, the Pharisees think that they are righteous. They think they're doing okay, that they have been good and upstanding stewards, that they've discharged their responsibilities. If you remember in chapter 15, the Pharisees are particularly represented by the older brother. In the story of the father and the two sons, the older brother is the one who stayed home and worked hard and therefore thinks that he is righteous. So the older brother says, he's refusing to come into the party for his little brother. This is chapter 15, verses 28 and 29. But he was angry and refused to go in, the older brother. And his father came out and entreated him. But the older brother answered his father, "Look, these many years I have served you and I never disobeyed your command. I am righteous. My behavior is correct." And yet, the older brother is willing to disparage his relationship with his father and put his father to shame. refusing to come into a family party is an unrighteous thing to do because it strains the relationship. And true righteousness is not just checking off a list of rules and behaviors. It is behaving rightly for the sake of loving and relating rightly. And so while the Pharisees' behavior complies with the whole checklist, they've done all the things, they've refrained from doing all the bad things, their relationship is not right. And they have no idea that they are unrighteous. So whereas the unrighteous steward knows himself to be unrighteous and is therefore wise, the Pharisees look at their behavioral checklist, think that qualifies them, and fail to understand that they too are unrighteous. And this makes them foolish. And Jesus tells this story to his disciples to say, be wise. Know yourselves. Be aware that you are unrighteous. Not every alcoholic can tell you that the first step in recovery is admitting that you have a problem. But every alcoholic who is aware of their own unrighteousness, who knows themselves to be an alcoholic, will tell you the first step in recovery is admitting that you have a problem. Jesus' invitation to his disciples, his invitation to you and me, is to be a community in recovery. A community where everyone present admits that they have a problem, knows that they need saving, is wise enough to see their own unrighteousness. And therefore, because we all know that we are in recovery, we are able to associate with one another without condemning each other. The way you can tell that the Pharisees don't know that they're unrighteous is because they think they're better than the unrighteous tax collectors and sinners, and they don't want to associate with them. And the way you can tell that the tax collectors and sinners know that the Pharisees think they're righteous is that the tax collectors and sinners don't want anything to do with the Pharisees because they don't want to hang out with people who are constantly judging and condemning them. The call of Jesus to his disciples is for each and every one of us, however well we've done on the behavior checklist, to know, I am unrighteous. So whatever Sandy's unrighteousness is, I can be a part of the same household as Sandy without looking down on her. Because we're just two people who need to be in recovery. Know yourself better to be a genuinely righteous, unrighteous, and wicked servant who is wise enough to know you are unrighteous than to be comparing behavioral checklists and looking down your nose at the people whose unrighteousness is a little more obvious than yours. Jesus holds up a deliberately unrighteous example to say, knowing yourself to be unrighteous is the first step to being my disciple. It's the first step. It's not the whole thing. It's not the whole thing because there's another character in the story whose character actually shapes the story more than the unrighteous steward's does. And the second wisdom that the unrighteous steward has is that he knows his master. He knows the master's character. Essentially, this is a story of a servant needing mercy from his master, getting it, and then realizing he needs more than mercy from his master, and betting his whole life that the master will be gracious as well as merciful. At the beginning of the story, the servant experiences the rich man, the master's mercy, And then he behaves as if the master will also give grace, and at the end of the story, he gets grace as well. Let me show you this. Okay. So the very first thing that happens is the master finds out that the steward has been unrighteous and squandered all, like a bunch of his property, and he brings him in and he fires him. Does that sound like mercy? It didn't sound like mercy to me at first. Until I was reading about the context, and the what was supposed to happen in context is that the master was supposed to find this out, not just fire the steward, but either enslave him into indentured servitude to pay off what he had squandered, or send him to debtor's prison to sit there until somebody showed up to bail him out by paying what he had squandered. The servant has incurred some enormous debt with the master. And so the proportionate response is to say, you can be free when you have paid me back. So to merely say, you're no longer allowed to be in charge of my remaining property, is an act of mercy. The master inflicts far less punishment than he could and even should according to justice. And once he has experienced that mercy, the dishonest, the unrighteous steward bets everything on the master giving grace as well. Right? So he has this plan he formulates. Right? He's gonna go to people who owe the master money, and he's gonna negotiate secret deals with them to shrink the debts. Right? He goes out and he does all of this. Here's the thing: the master is gonna find out. Right? The situation here is like the rich man, he's like the landowner. These are agricultural rents that are due, right? So like, let's say part of the amazing wealth of the Smith family is that Garrett owns half of Benton County, right? And so he doesn't want to farm half of Benton County himself, and he's heard that Peter is a good farmer. So he says to Peter, like, I'm gonna give you this 100 acres, right, which is expected to produce 300 bushels of wheat with good farming. I'm making all these figures up, Peter. Please bear with me, right? And if you produce 300 bushels, then you give 100 to me for the use of the land, and your income for the year is 200. Right? That's the arrangement. That's what these debts are. Right? The master is going to notice if all of a sudden all of the rents go down. Right? There's never been a landlord in history who wouldn't pick up on that. Right? He's going to find out, and then he's going to have a choice. He can either say, listen, this guy cut all these deals with you after I fired him. None of this is legitimate. You owe me what we agreed you owe me. Or he's going to say, I have the opportunity to be generous, to be gracious, to bless every single one of you and my unrighteous servant. And the servant bets everything on the master choosing the second option. And he's right. He sees and experiences mercy, and he bets on life-giving grace as well. Because right? Ultimately, all of the generosity he's going to experience from these tenants comes at the cost to the master. It is undeserved, needed generosity from the master to the unrighteous servant through the tenants. Everyone comes out better except the master. And he bets the master will agree to this. And the master does. Because the true master is not just merciful. He does not just hold back the just punishments we deserve. The true master is gracious. He gives to us life that costs him in spite of what we deserve. And the unrighteous steward knows this, and he is wise. The Pharisees, on the other hand, they know about this. They know about the true master, the Lord, being merciful and gracious. Like, it's all through the Bible, and the Pharisees are like world-leading experts on the Bible. Right? A few weeks ago, Christian read for us for our creed the central verse of the whole Old Testament. The name of God that gets repeated over and over and over again, right? The Lord, merciful and gracious, slow to anger, abounding in steadfast love and faithfulness. You can't be a Pharisee without knowing that. But they only know about it. They haven't experienced the mercy of God because they think they're righteous. They think they don't need it. And there's all the difference in the world between knowing and knowing about. Brian, one of our elders, is away this week helping a friend of his sail his boat up the coast, kind of 50, 100 miles offshore, up through the ocean for days on end, right? If you're going to call on a friend to help you sail a boat and you're not a sailing expert, I'll give you two choices. You can have the person who knows all about sailing, right? They took a class on the theory of shipbuilding, right? They downloaded the world's best app on celestial navigation. They're going to captain the boat for you. Or you can have the person who has sailed across the Pacific and back and been in between two waves that were taller than their mast and lived to tell the tale. Who do you want in the boat with you? The person who knows all about sailing or the person who knows from experience what it is to be in the grip of the wind and the waves? The Pharisees know all about the idea of God being merciful and gracious. The unrighteous steward has tasted God's mercy and bet his life on God's grace. And it's his wisdom that is worth imitating. And that's Jesus' invitation to his disciples. Bet your life. Bet your life on the mercy and grace of God. Don't bet your life on your not needing the mercy and grace of God because of how well you can behave. Bet your life that the Lord is merciful and gracious, slow to anger, and abounding and steadfast love, and know from experience that he will come through. Know the Master. This plays out, right? So Jesus is saying all of this to his disciples. That's what it tells us in verse 1, right? I want you to, I think of a few of the disciples who are there, right? So the Simon who becomes Peter is there, right? And he hasn't fully yet, but in a few chapters, he is going to experience the mercy of God. When Jesus is on his way to the cross and Peter has promised that he'll be the one who's courageous enough to stand up to the Roman soldiers with Jesus. And instead of being courageous, Peter is cowardly. He pretends he doesn't even know who Jesus is in order to save his own skin. And in that failure, in that manifest unrighteousness, Peter gets to experience the mercy and grace of God. There's a moment, it's just in this gospel, in the Gospel of Luke, when Peter is just denied even knowing Jesus. And on the other side of this massive courtyard, Jesus is being dragged away to be crucified. And Jesus looks across the crowd straight at Peter. I know exactly what you just did. And now I'm going to go die for you. Because I love you. And I am merciful and gracious. And you need to know that. Not just know about it. Know that you personally need God's mercy and his grace. You need to know yourself as the unrighteous steward does. You need to know your master by experience as the unrighteous steward comes to know him. You need to recognize that it is your sin, your failure, your desperate need to be in recovery that is the beginning of wisdom, of finding out by experience just how merciful and gracious God is. And that leads to knowing money. I think the hardest part of the whole passage is verse 9, where Jesus kind of gives the moral of the story here. He turns back to tell his disciples specifically, make friends for yourselves by means of unrighteous wealth so that when it fails, they may receive you into the eternal dwellings. I have so many questions. But the unrighteous steward knows money. And money here is, it's standing in as a sort of like window to the heart to show us who we really are, right? The revelation of whether or not we know ourselves and know God, in this case, is in our relationship with money and whether or not we know money. So the unrighteous steward, he knows at least that money is for relationships. All of his methods, all of his means are unrighteous. They are wicked. They are crooked. But he's at least got his priorities straight. I will take money that isn't mine, and I will make friends. He understands that in God's economy, money is for relationship. Even relationship with shady characters, right? All of these tenants, the people he's cutting deals with, are shady characters. They know what's up here, right? This is the ancient equivalent. Imagine that I work at the Toyota dealership, right? And Marta and I are friends, and I come to Marta and I say, hey, Marta, you've been driving that Subaru for a while now, right? I think you could really benefit from a new car. So here, I'd like to sell you a brand new Toyota RAV4 for $5,000, right? But here's the thing. You got to pay cash, and you got to pay it today, and I cannot get you the title, right? Is there any universe in which Marta thinks this is an above-board righteous transaction, right? She knows that I'm offering her stolen merchandise, right? If she signs up for this, it does not speak well of her righteousness, right? And yet it is good, it is wise, that the unrighteous steward has made friends this way, made this kind of friends. Not righteous. It's not the fullness of what he's supposed to be doing, but it is wise because he at least understands the point of money is to form relationships. The Pharisees, on the other hand, they don't even know that they have prioritized money over relationships. So we learn about the Pharisees in verse 14 of chapter 16 that they are lovers of money. Right? That they are addicted to money. They think it will be the thing that gets them the good life, even as it's costing them relationships. It costs them relationship with Jesus. They ridicule Jesus because they are lovers of money. It costs them relationship with the tax collectors and the sinners. Because you know who's not useful to the leader of a church? The richest guy in town who won't tithe. That's the tax collector. Or the prostitute who won't even come to church and make a contribution. That's the sinner. Part of why the Pharisees won't relate to them is they aren't useful for their real purposes. Friends, how much is this the culture we live and breathe in? Like, how common is a view of money where this is the thing that will get us the good life, even as it costs us relationships? How much is money our most common and best hidden addiction? How much like Pharisees are we? Showing up for church on Sunday and then organizing the rest of our lives to maximize our income, to prove ourselves in ways that are financially rewarding? How much do we have to learn from the wisdom of the unrighteous steward, the priorities of the dishonest manager? That's exactly what Jesus commands his disciples to do. Make friends for yourselves by means of unrighteous wealth, so that when it fails, they may receive you into the eternal dwellings. Make friends for yourselves by means of unrighteous wealth. The the words there, unrighteous wealth. So it's the same unrighteous as has been used for the manager. And then the word for wealth is actually the word mammon, which isn't even a Greek word. It was a word from the local language where Jesus lived, and it referred not just to money, but to the spiritual force, the cosmic evil that wants to make money the point of your existence. Right? Mammon was a demon, a false god, whose goal for you is to care more about getting and saving and spending money than you do about anything else. And Mammon doesn't care if you say every Sunday, the Lord is merciful and gracious, slow to anger, abounding in steadfast love and faithfulness. As long as your checkbook says, I care most about getting and saving and spending money. And Jesus says to his disciples, notice he doesn't say, that is spiritual evil, that is demonic, you have to avoid that at all costs. No money for any of you. Instead, he says, use money for the purpose I gave it, for the forming of relationships. I am very far from knowing everybody's financial situation. I know we have quite the wide range in the room. All of us, down to people who've never held a job in their lives yet, have some degree of surplus money. It might be a few dollars in a piggy bank. It might be enough in retirement for your grandchildren to live off the dividends for the next 100 years. There is some surplus, though. What is it for? Or to ask the more Jesus-focused question, who is it for? Who are you meant to make friends with, bless, draw closer to through the money that's been entrusted to you? That's the call of Jesus to his disciples. That's wisdom with money. Neither avoiding it like the plague, nor secretly worshiping it like the God that will make you live the good life, but using it for its God-given purpose of forming and deepening relationships. Take the $2 that you have and take someone out and split a coffee, because in 2026, with $2, you need a half of a coffee. Right. Or take the surplus income and plan as far in advance as you need to bring everyone in your extended household together for 2 weeks to enjoy one another and deepen in relationship. Or something entirely different. But the point of money is not independence, but relationship. Know that and be wise, even as the unrighteous steward was wise. And you know what Jesus says happens then? He says the people you make friends with will welcome you into eternal dwellings. Is that not mind-blowing? Like, I take my surplus income and I go out of my way to befriend the homeless man who's been sleeping between the church and the garden. And then I arrive at the end of my life at the pearly gates, and he's waiting to welcome me in. He's my credibility that I know myself to be unrighteous, and I have bet my life on the mercy and grace of God. This is so counterintuitive to me. I've read stories, some you may be familiar with, where like famous Christians imagine themselves being welcomed in and guided through heaven, right? Dante's Divine Comedy, right? is this, the story of being guided through the areas of the afterlife, where C.S. Lewis in The Great Divorce, and they usually have some hero of theirs as the tour guide, right? Lewis has this guy, George MacDonald, whom he had looked up to all his life, who was a couple generations older. Dante uses Virgil, the Roman poet who wrote the Aeneid, right? Some like great, glorious person in the past. Jesus says, no, it doesn't work like that. You're going to be welcomed in by the people you used to look down on, by the people you had spent years assuming, I got nothing to learn from them. And then you are so moved by the experience of God's mercy and grace that you spend whatever money is available to you to befriend them. And they will be the one on Jesus' behalf to say, welcome home, sister. Let me show you around. Who is it? Don't leave this in the realm of abstraction. When Jesus says, make friends for yourselves by means of unrighteous mammon, every single one of those friends has a name, has a story, has an insatiably human need to be loved and befriended. Who is Jesus saying to you? Make friends with them by means of whatever money is available to you. The unrighteous steward doesn't stick with the principle, with the abstract prioritizing of relationships over wealth. He goes to people with names and stories and makes friends with them. And he is commended for his wisdom, even in the midst of his unrighteous methods. Who will it be for you? Jesus holds up this example, this unrighteous steward, who in his wisdom, in his prudence, knows himself, knows his master, knows what money is for. And seeing this and seeing the context has helped me some. And yet after all that, we come back to every single thing the steward does in the story is unrighteous, is sleazy and underhanded. And he's the one who gets commended. We're not meant to leave that tension, that discomfort behind. Rather, being forced to have a hero who is obviously and relentlessly unrighteous is meant to awaken or deepen in us the longing for some righteous steward somewhere. Oh, couldn't there be a story where the master sent out his righteous steward to administer mercy and grace, to go to every single one of the tenants, however underhanded and scummy and sleazy they themselves are, and say, I've come to absorb your debt, to relieve you from a burden you cannot pay, and to give to you a life you cannot earn, and to take all of the costs for it on myself. Oh, for a story with an actually righteous steward. Not this guy. Not you or me or our favorite modern Pharisee. Only Jesus. Only Jesus who said, blessed are you when you hunger and thirst for righteousness, for you will be satisfied. And I will satisfy you. Only Jesus, who though he knew no sin, became sin, that we might become the righteousness of God. Friends, learn from the wisdom of the unrighteous steward. Come to know yourselves as in need of recovery. Come to know your master as abounding in mercy and grace. Come to know what money is really for and to practice life that way. But don't let that growing wisdom cover up or diminish the longing for actual righteousness. Jesus left a hole in the middle of the story on purpose, that we might long for it to be filled and learn to look to him as the only one who could ever fill it. Let's pray. Lord, thank you for the gift of wisdom. And thank you for your penchant for offering wisdom through unrighteous examples, through underhanded sneaks like Jacob and deniers like Peter and murderers like Paul. Give us ears to hear the wisdom you are offering us. Teach us to know ourselves and to know you and to know what this money we're immersed in is really for. More than that, Lord, teach us to be hungry, to hunger and thirst for real righteousness, for a pure and perfect behavior that leads to a pure and loving relationship we cannot achieve on our own and cannot live without. Teach us to find who we're looking for in Jesus Christ alone. Amen.